Well, welcome back to Coast with our special guest, Scott Portzline, as we talk about the possibilities, the dangers to our nuke power plants. They're out there. They're real. And Scott is, of course, trying to ring the bell, send the message to the world that we need to take care of this problem. We're going to come back. We'll talk more with him and take your calls on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, we're back with Scott Portzline. We're going to take your calls as well. A few more questions, too. Scott, what's happening with Iran and its endeavors to build nuclear power?
Well, they're moving forward, and the United States is helping them. And I'm actually not against that for this reason. I believe we're going to sabotage them again from the inside, like we did with the Stuxnet virus.
Yes.
That virus was so powerful, however, there was a backlash from it. And there's additional worries because within 48 hours, the coding was figured out by some other hackers, and they can modify it to do whatever they would like to do with it. It caused problems at a Soviet nuclear plant. We don't know much detail about it, but that's the word from other researchers. And it caused problems here in industries in the United States. To the tune of between 50 and 100 industries had problems with it. And that's one, I can't think of the word right now, property of the people that run their businesses. They don't want to reveal when they've been attacked because of the stockholders and the embarrassment and the legalities that go with it.
Tell us what a dirty bomb is.
Well, a dirty bomb is actually very simple. It's explosives laden with radioactive materials, so that when it goes off, it disperses radioactive materials. There's also things called radiological dispersal devices, which is what these dirty drones would be. And so what's happened this year, just a couple of months ago, the United States General Accounting or Accountability Office, they changed the name a few years ago, they created three fictitious companies to see if they could get a license to obtain materials that were dangerous, radioactive materials. And in two of the cases, they did not, they were denied. But in the third case, the inspector came out to look at the facility. There was nothing in their phony facility, but they convinced him that they were going to put those things in there as soon as they got the license. So on the spot, he handed them a license so that they could buy radioactive materials. Well, that's how, another way that people can get these dangerous materials. And as far as the effects of them, it would possibly cause cancers years later, but there's probably not going to be immediate deaths from a radioactive bomb, a dirty bomb. The exception would be some of the very virulent isotopes if they became embedded in the bodies of people, even for a short period of time, that could kill them.
Would we know instantly that radioactive material might have been used in some kind of attack?
No. That's one of the problems that I've met with my own local city officials, saying that these emergency responders, if they're going to any type of emergency, a fire or a car accident, they need to have their Geiger counters turned on because there's accidents on the highway every year with radioactive materials, and there's radioactive materials in buildings that people have forgotten about, and they need to know it. So I can see a scenario where there's a bomb that goes off and nobody turns on the Geiger counters for the first hour or half an hour, and then it takes another half hour to tell people about it. So the number one rule, and I was actually able to get Homeland Security to change this on their ready.gov site, I believe it is. If there's a bomb that goes off in a building or whatever and the dust is in the air, the first thing you need to do is get away from that area and cover your mouth and nose with a damp cloth so you don't breathe in the particulates.
But the biggest problem is you don't know if it's just a conventional bomb, the dirty bomb.
Right. But one thing that would happen early on, especially with a strong bomb, there'd be nausea and vomiting, bleeding, diarrhea.
Blisters.
Say it again?
Blisters.
That would come a little bit later, but if it were strong, yeah. Well, one of the things that happened at Chernobyl, two of the men were sent to go look at the reactor because the chief of the operations who was doing the test that night didn't realize that the reactor had blown up, and it's gone, completely gone. He sent them to lower the control rods manually. They came back with a dark suntan, and 2 weeks later they were dead.
Wow. Let's go to some of the calls. Wildcard line, Ron is in Hitchcock, Texas. Welcome to the program. Hi, Ron. Go ahead.
Good morning, George. Good morning to your guest.
Hi there.
Hi. I've called you before, and we chatted a little bit about, what's really behind all this. From the Kennedy assassination to the Twin Towers, I'd like to see if your guest has any knowledge on the regards to implosions. There were several witnesses that heard implosions of the Twin Towers, and this New World Order. I believe there's a lot to the reason why these things happen. So I'll hang up and listen.
All right, your take on some of that, Scotty.
Well, I believe that the Twin Towers came down because of the unique design, where they basically unzipped from the top down. And as far as people describing explosions and or implosions, I don't believe that they were actually hearing other bombs going off that were inside the building. There's a lot of physics that go along and explanations from people saying that it was an inside job. I'll give you one example of, if you know all the physics, then things make more sense. They say that some parts of that building fell at a speed greater than gravity would cause something to fall. Well, the whip effect, if you have a piece that's momentarily hinged at the bottom and the top starts to fall away from the bottom, it sort of whips. It accelerates where it is actually moving, that part of it, the end of it, it is moving faster than gravity, and then it unhinges and it falls. Well, the center of gravity on that piece never violated any of the laws of physics. So, it's like the moon landing. There's a lot of explanations, and some of the explanations can easily be overcome when you know more physics.
None of it, though, explains Building 7, Scott.
I know. I don't know what
there
to
you
make
go.
Of that.
Buildings like that just don't collapse the same way as the other two.
Yeah, if we're going to talk conspiracy, I'd love to. In fact, the anniversary of Three Mile Island is coming up in March. If you want to talk about the sabotage evidence there and how the investigators really suspected that sabotage was involved, they actually asked the FBI to come in and do a sabotage investigation.
Didn't John Fuller write a book about the Fermi plant in Michigan?
Yeah.
We almost lost Detroit. Wasn't that the name of it?
Yes, and I know you're interested in that.
That's, oh, yeah, hometown.
It wasn't really true that they almost lost Detroit, but they were headed for big troubles, and that was with a breeder reactor. And breeder reactors just aren't working out all around the world. Japan just canceled their Manju reactor for the third time.
Wow.
They canceled it this month. So they had fires over there. In fact, what happened in 1999, I was on another nationwide radio show, and the host kind of surprised me near the end. He said, "Scott, where will the next nuclear accident be?" And I really hadn't thought about it, but my instinct said Japan. And I was later asked by a nuclear engineer for the Union of Concerned Scientists, how did I know? How did I know Fukushima was going to happen? And I said, well, of course, I didn't really know, but what I saw happening in Japan was the same that happened right here at Three Mile Island before they had their emergency from the meltdown. And that was, they were having more and more incidents. They were dismissing them as meaningless or, that's not really a big safety issue. And they were also covering up. And that's what was going on in Japan. At Manju, they had a fire. First, they said they didn't even have it. Then they covered up the videotapes, came out, and the criminal allegations were made. And that's also what happened at Three Mile Island. There was criminal falsification going on within the company regarding leak rates coming out of that reactor. If they had been shut down like they should have been, there wouldn't have been an emergency on that day.
Let's go to Pi, truck driving in Kansas. Hi, Pi. Good morning. Go ahead.
Hey, how y'all doing?
Great, thank you.
Good, good. Hey, just enjoying the conversation here on this nuclear sabotage thing. I had a question. Maybe Scott could answer this.
Okay.
I know he mentioned something about the high cost of babysitting this nuclear material or nuclear waste for power plants or medical facilities, which makes it kind of cost prohibitive for a lot of utility companies. I used to work for a utility company out in Arizona. They have the Palo Verde nuclear plant out there. A question, I know I toured the website down at southeastern New Mexico some 20 years ago. Curious of how much that material is being stored there in those salt beds. And I guess my next question would be is why couldn't they send that nuclear waste out into outer space, particularly send it right into the sun? Would that be a problem for, you know, getting rid of
that?
Boy,
if something pie happened to that the rocket as it was being launched, what a disaster. But I'll let you answer them, Scott.
Yeah, what was the name of the facility he was talking about with salt?
It's called the WIP site.
Oh, yeah, right. I was just reading again about that, you know, preparing for the show. And they have much more damage there than they believed. And it's really affecting waste sites around the country and the world because they're starting to realize we really don't understand everything that can go wrong. And so it's put the screeching brakes on some of the plans to open up other sites. Well, that means that there's more nuclear waste sitting out in parking lots, so to speak. And they're going to have to start moving it to temporary sites, and there's big fights going on, and the government's acting like, well, we can sell this to some places, some cities, or some townships, whatever, who can make some money this way, and they're going to try to do that. Well, who wants that coming through your town? And as far as sending it to the sun or into space, that would be a great solution if it wasn't so expensive and risky, and nobody would stand for that. In fact, there were protesters who are against sending reactors into space, even these small amounts of plutonium and so forth, that if there was a disaster where the rocket fails, they could disperse enough plutonium to theoretically kill everyone in the world. That wouldn't happen that way, but there's a legitimate concern there.
Yeah.
I'm not very worried about that.
What about the sea life, the fish life? If it landed in the ocean, would it wipe out all the fish life?
Not all the ocean is a great dilution source, but we just don't need any more radiation in our food, and that's what's happening. They're seeing it off the coast of Oregon coming from Fukushima with the cesium-134, and that has a half-life that's so short that they can almost guarantee that that radiation source was Fukushima because of the meltdown daughter products that occur. 134 has a 2.5-year half-life, I believe.
All right, back to Thomas in La Jolla, California now. He's on the wild card line. Thomas, go ahead.
George, thank you for taking my call, and Happy New Year to the Coast to Coast staff.
Yes, sir.
You. Scott, you're doing marvelous work. I wanted to ask you a question, Scott, about the Los Angeles Basin. There are two reactors. One is San Onofre, which is being decommissioned, and the nuclear waste is being stored on site. But there was another reactor, and that's the Santa Susana Test Facility. And currently it's being run by NASA and Boeing as part of a consortium. But allegedly there was a radiation release and possibly a meltdown in the 1950s that was covered up, and as serious as Three Mile Island or Chernobyl. And I was wondering if you knew anything about the Santa Susana test site. I know there's been a number of Freedom of Information Act requests to find out what actually happened in the 1950s, whether there was a radiation release over Los Angeles. And I was curious, do you know anything about that incident?
Yes, you're absolutely right with everything that you said there. In fact, the radiation release was worse than Three Mile Island. And I highly recommend, George, that you have a man on the show named Daniel Hirsch, who is with the Committee to Bridge the Gap from Los Angeles. And he has done quite a bit of research and helped explode that story into the news a number of years ago. So the incident, it did involve a meltdown and total cover-up at that time. And there are people that say their cancers who lived in the Los Angeles area during those years came from the nuclear meltdown. So that's a great story there, and it should be aired out once again, because we've got to get away from relying on nuclear power, and that's happening. with our wind power and solar power, that's beginning to win the day. We're really doing well there.
You know, Scott, I'm kind of excited about this Tesla self-contained unit for the home.
I didn't look at that yet, but tell me about it.
Well, it's like a battery for the home, and it'll run the house. And so you don't have to worry about any power outages or anything, much smaller than a generator. But it's all self-contained, and it would just take care of your own needs.
Is it like the Bloom Box? Are you familiar with that term?
I am not.
That was on 60 Minutes. Well, what is the power source? You said it's like a generator or a battery.
It's like it's electrical, so it's almost battery-like, but not quite.
Well, I'm wondering how it's storing the electricity or how it's boosting electricity. I'll have to look at it.
Yeah, check into that.
Yeah, well, I see someday the hydrogen economy is really being the answer. I'm so pleased with the LED lights right now because it's changing the light bill for cities, especially, even though the...
And they last forever.
Yeah, and they're cheap as can be.
I've got an LED portable light on my studio desk in Los Angeles that Bob Crane sent me, and... When I first started there back in 2003, coming up on 14 years, by the way, this weekend, but he sent me this, and it's the same bulb. It's been on when I'm in L.A. every night for 4 to 5 hours a night, and it's the same bulb I've had for 14 years.
Well, that's great, and don't buy the cheap ones because some of the cheaper-built ones, they actually fade in their brightness, so get the good ones.
Let's go next to David in Dallas, see if we have some time to get you in before the break. David, thanks for calling.
Hey, good evening, gentlemen.
Hi, David.
I was listening to another program before yours, and I don't know if you know Jim Bohannon.
Oh, but, yes, know Jim well.
He was talking about electromagnetic pulses, and
yes.
That kind of ties into your show. I was wondering what happens... If an EMP goes off.
Well, let me tell you, because, David, we are champions in that area because we've been talking about this for 2.5 years now to get our power grid insulated from an EMP attack, that's a nuke detonated in the atmosphere, or a solar flare from the sun, which could take out our power grid, and it is a disaster. For $2 billion, we can insulate the grid. They estimate that 300 million Americans would be dead within the first year if something like that takes down the power grid for any long period of time. So we are deeply into that. Scott, that's one thing I would hope President-elect Donald Trump would work on as soon as he gets into office.
Absolutely, and you are the champions of that right now, and I appreciate it greatly.
We are not going to stop, and we're going to come back in just a moment here on Coast to Coast AM with Scott Portzline and take final phone calls as we talk about cyber attacks on the grid, all kinds of problems. You've heard it. We'll talk more about it when we come back. And it's our final segment with Scott Portzline as we talk about just protecting our nuclear power plants. There are 99 online right now. I thought we had more, Scott. What happened? They took them off?
Yeah, they're mostly the problems are financial. They're not earning any money. In fact, two states have just bailed out nuclear plants belonging to the Exelon Corporation to the tune of about $8 billion in each state. So if it weren't for corporate welfare, we'd have lost another dozen plants in the next year or two.
What's the latest with Chernobyl? I know they've built kind of like a dome around it now, haven't they?
Yeah, and that's been planned, and they sought out monies from around the world to do that. They're finding that the mushrooms that are grown in the area around the plant are radioactive.
Oh, boy.
And farmers that are living, 30 miles away. And they actually, the Ukraine arrested a reporter just a few weeks ago who was reporting on that, saying that he's making it all up. But in court, the truth is going to come out.
Yeah, if they don't do something to him.
Yeah, you never know.
Well, what was happening? Cows tainted? Farmers tainted?
Well, this story was about mushrooms being sold to other countries, and they were radioactive. Of course,
Magic mushrooms, for sure, huh?
Yeah, and once that starts, then you affect the entire industry because people will be afraid to eat mushrooms, period.
Well, let me ask you something. If you eat something that's been tainted with radioactivity, what will that do to you?
Well, it could trigger cancer. The odds are against it, but it depends on how much. And so there's different types of radioactivity. You would have to have a particle that lodges in your system. Radon, you know, that goes into your lungs, and then it affects your bloodstream. There was a lot of leukemias, which is cancer of the bloodstreams around Three Mile Island from ingesting the different isotopes that are in the gaseous form, like xenon and I forget what all came out right now, but there are 240-some different radionuclides come out during a nuclear accident, and some people say even more. Well, if these particles lodge in your body, they can continue to irradiate cells. Now, our bodies are pretty good at correcting the issues and repairing the damage, but some people lose that lottery. And so, yeah, you don't want to eat radioactive food. We eat radioactive bananas all the time. There's some radioactive potassium in there, and people die of cancer all the time. So who knows? You know, epidemiology is very, very complex, and it's an inexact science.
Indeed it is. All right, we go to Carlos in Carson, California now. Carlos, take it away.
Yes, good evening, George and Scott. Well, Scott here, you know, I have a friend who worked at the San Onofre nuclear power plant. He was an engineer there. And he told me that they were very reliable against any accidents because they had so many backup systems in so many different sectors. He said if something happened, it was probably sabotage. And I believe that is really what happened in Fukushima, Chernobyl, and many of these other places. They've been deliberately sabotaged. Why? Because the New World Order wants, you know, there's like hysteria that's created about pollution, and it lands right into the New World Order agenda. Now, let me tell you something else. Greenpeace, the Sierra Club, and many other of these environmental organizations, they have on their directorship people from the oil companies. Now, isn't that a giant contradiction?
That's a conflict of interest for sure, Carlos, I would think. But it's all over the place, Scott, isn't it?
Well, sure, there's board members. In fact, Three Mile Island Alert has a person who's on the board of nuclear facilities. Why? Because he gets to have a say with the shareholders and the stockholders as to what's going on at their company. And as far as sabotage at Chernobyl, I don't believe that's the case. The explanations make total sense to me of what caused that accident, and the same with Fukushima. But I do know that whenever there's a big disaster, there are rumors of sabotage, and sometimes they're true.
We are now going to Skype. Michelle is on a train in Japan. But hey, Michelle, go ahead. Michelle, are you there?
I am there. Sorry.
Great. There you are. Go ahead.
Couldn't hear you there for a second. Yes. Oh, hi. I'm on a train here in southern Japan. And I wanted to ask the guest if he knows anything about the Hamaoka nuclear power plant. I live in Shizuoka Prefecture, and we have a plant called the Hamaoka nuclear power plant. It's right by the ocean, and our region has a very large fault, which they are expecting any time in the next, you know, 5 to 20 years to have an earthquake that's, you know, on the scale of a 6 to 7, maybe even as much as an 8, called the Great Tokai Earthquake, and they're really worried about that reactor. And I was wondering if he knew anything about that and Japan's policy in general, because the opinion here seems really varied, and it's kind of hard to pin down what people think about it in Japan.
All right, Scott, and isn't that amazing with technology? I mean, there she is on a train in Japan listening to the program and talking to you, Scott.
I know, isn't that something? Maybe later on tonight I'll make the Mars rovers move around again.
Absolutely. But what do you know about Japan and specifically that plant?
I don't know too much about that plant other than they're all boiling water reactors. So that is the same type of plant at Fukushima. I think it's more modern, so maybe the reactor building is a little more secure.
I hope so.
Yeah, I do, too. But Japan, right now, their culture is the battle where people believe that they have to support their government, that the government would not lie to them. And then the other half of the people realize the government's been lying to them and covering up. So you have a very big disconnect, and people are at odds with each other. Well, just this month, the government of Japan decided that the utility is not going to have to pay for the cost of decontamination and recovery from that accident. Well, it couldn't. There's no way a company can. In fact, Japan's been in recession for 2 decades, and with this nuclear accident, I don't see how they're going to recover unless they falsify things or prop up their dollar with phony methods.
Okay, Michelle, thank you. Be careful out there in Japan. It's still amazing technology. Mike is out there in Montana now. Hey, Mike, go ahead.
Good evening, gentlemen. I just I used to live south of the Three Mile Island plant.
All right.
I lived right across from Annapolis on a little island there called Kent Island. Before that accident, that bay, the Chesapeake Bay, used to be dark blue. Very clean. You could eat anything out of that area. My brother still lives there, and he told me, I asked him last year if he wanted to go fishing. He said, are you kidding? He said, I wouldn't eat the fish that come out of that bay for anything. He says they still have red spots and sores on them. The crabs have been about decimated. The clamming is just about gone. Oysters, clams, stuff like that. It affected millions of fishermen. I know that for sure because I was one of them. And I was just wondering, how long does it take to clean up an area naturally, because it doesn't seem like the government's doing anything to help remedy that situation. So is there anything that can be done to speed the process up, or is it just a 1,000 years and whatever?
You know? And it depends on how contaminated, Scott, it is, right?
Yeah. And he's right to ask that question because the amount of money that it would cost to try to do anything with filters and so forth would bankrupt the nation also. So this is one reason nuclear power is such a bad idea. As far as the Chesapeake Bay, one of the big problems they're having there is from the nitrates in the fertilizer running off and choking the water with the algae that grows. And there are tumors on fish from radiation. In fact, they found that right here in the Harrisburg area, just north of Three Mile Island, about 2 years ago. So there's connections to releases that come out of nuclear plants. Nuclear plants, by the way, they brag that they have zero releases of the carbon, earth-warming gases, but they release hundreds of thousands of pounds of chemicals to the waterways every year.
We have Barbara now in Los Angeles. Hey, Barbara, thanks for holding, and you're up with us. Go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to ask your guest. I live near UCLA, and I had heard several years ago that they had their own power plant, and that's something I wanted to know, and then I want to know if other college campuses have that, and I'll listen off the air.
Yes, that's a research reactor. They have one here at Penn State also, and they've actually had some disturbing problems with those. ABC News did a report on phony students who went in and had security clearances to work at the reactors and the troubles that went on there. So far, there hasn't been a major problem at a university reactor, but that's just going to change for various reasons. One of them, of course, would be the sabotage or the terrorist attack.
Keith is in St. Louis now. Let's get you in here, Keith. Go ahead.
Okay, I got two questions for,
all right,
for Scott.
Sure thing.
One is nuclear waste. That gives off an incredible amount of heat when it's stored.
Oh, yes. That's why most of it is in pools. And if not, after it cools down for a while, they can put it in casks that require air to circulate through them.
All right. Now, I understand here in St. Louis we have a problem with this nuclear waste.
Yeah, that's the fire underground at Westlake.
Yes. Can could somebody design a technology to use a nuclear waste to power energy? It would make sense to me that if it's going to be that hot, why don't we just use it and use it up?
Well, yes, it is doable. You wouldn't use it all up, but it's far too expensive. So they have reprocessing plants, and it's very expensive. You actually even create additional nuclear waste from the equipment and containers that you have to use. I don't see that happening until we maybe learn some new physics. There's always the promise. You know, the nuclear industry has been guilty of this for 50 years. No. We will know what to do to make things better in our next generation of nuclear reactors. Okay, and in 20 years, we'll know what to do with the waste. Well, that never happens.
Okay, I got one other question.
Okay,
for you.
Keith.
What about geothermal energy? I understand we have the Yellowstone Park caldera, which is, from what I understand, has raised its crest 1 foot in the last 50 years.
Are you talking about energy, or are you talking about a potential disaster?
Well, a little of both. I'm thinking that if we could tap that pressure and use it for geothermal energy to create electricity, we could relieve the pressure that's building up under the caldera.
Yeah, I don't know too much about that in geothermal. I'm a fan of it. I think the most simple solution is that people, even here in Pennsylvania, where the weather gets cold enough in the wintertime, is have pipes buried underground so that their air pumps in their home don't have to draw the cold air, the real cold air. It can get the 45-degree air instead of the 20-degree air during the wintertime. They call them heat pumps. That's what I was looking for.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, Keith, thank you. Good questions, by the way. You're on top of it. Scott, as we take final questions, what do you recommend people do? Is there anything that we can do as individuals to try to ensure a little more safety of these plants?
Well, definitely get involved with some of the hearings that go on. Talk to your local legislators. They usually tend to pass that on to they dismiss you and pass it on to the federal people because they say we have no jurisdiction there. But we have to start rattling change because now, you know, they're looking for bailouts, and certainly states are the ones providing the bailouts, and we have the power to say don't do that. In Japan, they charge the nuclear plant operators, the owners, with negligence. At first, the government decided they weren't going to charge any or file any charges against them. But in Japan, they have a special rule that the people can veto that and cause them to be charged, which is what they've done. Now I'm expecting the Japanese government to sit on that for a number of years until it goes away, and they'll never see their time in court, let alone receive fines or go to prison.
Mark in Baltimore, welcome to the program. Mark, thank you. Go ahead.
It's a joy to talk to you again, George, and I thank you for taking my telephone
call.
Sure
thing.
Thank you, sir. Simple question. Remember the movie The China Syndrome with Jack Lemmon and James Bond?
Yep, and Roman Polanski, right?
Right, and that dealt with a situation that they called a meltdown. It was very scary, and I haven't seen it since it first came out. But does that scenario exist where something happens with the reactor and something in the reactor can melt and go down to the Earth's core?
Well, that was an exaggeration, but it was the term China Syndrome was an actual term used even before the accident at Three Mile Island. And the movie producers picked up on it. In fact, they said it could render an area the size of the state of Pennsylvania uninhabitable. And so people were suspicious that Hollywood sabotaged TMI to make people want to go see their movie. Yeah, the fuel can melt. It gets so hot that it'll go through steel, concrete, and so forth. In Japan, at Fukushima, they have no idea of the size of the problem yet because they've sent they can't go in to the reactors. They've sent robots in, but in each case, the robots failed. So they think there's about 800 tons of nuclear fuel that has melted, and they are going to try to find a way to remove it. And they're talking about 40 years they need to decommission it at a cost of $68 billion. That estimate keeps going up, and it's still far too low. This, in my opinion, is a level 8 accident. I created that, and we talked about that on Coast to Coast a couple of years back. But level 8 would be
that it requires monitoring around the world and intervention and money and technical assistance around the world, that that's how severe it is.
Scott, what got you into this? Three Mile Island?
Yeah, I was in Thule, Greenland when that happened at the scene of a lost nuclear bomb where Navy SEALs and Seabees were trying to ascertain whether there was still some plutonium on the ocean floor. Denmark was about to give up the rule over Greenland. Greenland was going to gain its independence. When Three Mile Island happened, I came home about a week or so later. There was a blizzard up there that held us up from returning. We came back to Harrisburg, and I asked my friends what happened, because I believed in science. I believed in nuclear power. And some of them said, well, there were some things in the newspaper that it was caused by sabotage. And I thought, wow, that's interesting, but I didn't look into it for 5 years. So within 30 minutes, I discovered that the FBI was requested to do an investigation as to why valves had been closed for the emergency feed water and wires pulled off of terminals and other things like that. There's about 11 different suspected actions or lack of actions that occurred at TMI that caused investigators to think something happened there.
All right, my friend. Scott, thank you for the information. Let's stay in touch. Have a great new year, and I'm sure we'll be talking in 2017. Up next, ancient civilizations. Robert Schock joins us on Coast to Coast AM.